Good morning and welcome to Barbara Jordan Conference Center and to this briefing on healthcare coverage for children and families, state developments and trends that can inform the federal health policy debate. We are very pleased today to have you all with us as we look at these issues with the reauthorization of the state Children's Health Insurance Program before the Congress and renewed efforts and interest at the state level in expanding coverage for children and as well as for other uninsured populations. Several states have moved forward with proposals to expand health insurance coverage for their residents, and some are utilizing the lessons that we have learned from a decade of experience with the state Children's Health Insurance Program, SCHIP, to help inform their plans. This briefing today is to highlight state developments in covering children and families to help inform the policy agenda. And we are very pleased at this briefing to be able to have a keynote speaker who is a leading governor in the movement to try and provide broader coverage for children. I'm told he's just arrived in the building and will be with us momentarily. It's always great to know that your keynote speaker has arrived, and so we're delighted with that. But let me just say what a pleasure it is to have Governor Edward Rendell with us today. He is Pennsylvania's 45th governor, the chief executive of the nation's sixth most populous state. He has a state budget of $26 billion. That is a monumental feat to being able to support the kinds of services that the residents of Pennsylvania want and need within cost containment management. So he's got a very proud record there, but where we are really pleased to welcome him and have him join us today is in his leadership role in healthcare access for the residents of Pennsylvania and especially for all of Pennsylvania's children. His prescription for Pennsylvania would cover all children, improve access to affordable healthcare coverage, improve the quality of care, and get healthcare costs under control for both employers and employees. Affordability, accessibility, and quality, what we need and demand in our healthcare system. We're anxious to hear from him about how Pennsylvania has put these elements together and to get the governor's insights into national policy. I'm told that Pennsylvania has been a model before, and I hope it will be a model this time for moving us forward on health care coverage in the country. When SCHIP was enacted, the federal legislators looked to the Pennsylvania experience in covering children as a model for SCHIP, and today I hope the governor's prescription for Pennsylvania will become a model for how we reform health care in the nation. Thank you, Governor, and welcome to the Barbara Jordan Conference Center and to our forum. Good timing. Perfect.
Could someone get me a little water? So, hello, everyone. Nice to be here. And normally it doesn't work out this well. We're okay, thanks. Normally it doesn't work out this well, but this is great timing. Appreciate it. We started out when I became governor in 2003, looking at the healthcare arena, and the most immediate push was for our seniors. That was the group that was most vocal during the campaign. We have a wonderful prescription drug program started by Governor Bob Casey called PACE and PACENET, but it had suffered from the fact that costs, of course, kept going up, and more seniors were being bumped out of the income eligibility framework because when their Social Security COLAs kicked in, they were bumped out. We'd gone from 460,000 seniors in our PACE program to about 217 by the time I became governor. So our first initiative was a series of cost containment initiatives and increasing the scope and reach of our lottery. And we've been able to add, we were able to add immediately 100,000 people to the PACE program, build it back to 317. And then with Medicare Part D wrapped around the states that had existing prescription drug programs, and only three really have significant existing prescription drug programs, New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania. And wrapping around, we were able to add another 100,000 people. So we were almost back to where we were at the height of the patient-based network. We're going to have over 400,000 seniors in that program. But we obviously knew we had to do more in healthcare. And I created a new department in the state government called the Office of Healthcare Reform, and chose a wonderful woman who had been the CEO of Core States Bank, an enormously successful leader and administrator by the name of Rosemary Greco, to come in and head up the Office of Healthcare Reform. And literally by about 2004, mid-2004, we started planning for how to spread universal access in Pennsylvania to all of our citizens. And we put together panels of 101 citizens and worked on it for 2.5 years. And in that process, the first message we heard from almost all the stakeholders is, start with the kids. And that made abundant sense to me. In the richest country in the world, going through presently, every other day the stock market breaks all records. For us to have any uninsured citizens seems to me to be a tremendous moral failing. But to have children without health care, and have the thought of a 5-year-old child getting pediatric leukemia, which today is 90% curable, but not being able to have any chance of being cured because her parents had no coverage, that thought was so overwhelming that we did start with the kids. We worked on a model, and we put in legislation in the spring of 2006, and right before the election, about 10 days before the election, I signed a bill which we call Cover All Kids. And it will, by 2009, cover all of the children in Pennsylvania, or at least give their parents the opportunity to have them covered at a very affordable rate. What we did, it's relatively simple. We took the existing CHIP program, and of course, our Cover All Kids is endangered by the questions around the SCHIP reauthorization. But assuming that SCHIP is reauthorized and reauthorized at a decent funding level, we will be able to cover all Pennsylvania children by 2009. We basically took the CHIP model. Pennsylvania is one of, I think, 7 states that extends its CHIP coverage to 235% of poverty. We took that CHIP model and we built up and looked at the working poor, the people whose children aren't covered, and we moved a subsidized product up to 300% of poverty. And depending where you are, between 235 and 300, you contribute. You contribute per child per month, but a relatively small amount and clearly an affordable amount. And then at 300% or above, you pay our costs. And our costs are roughly, for the CHIP program, about $148 a month. Not cheap, but certainly affordable. And as a result, we can cover, literally, offer an affordable product, a good basic product. And you know the SCHIP product is a good basic product to all children in the state. Well, it was a little political fighting and pulling and tugging to get that done. We had a good, we're still in negotiations with CMS as to the extent of the federal participation, but we think it's going to work out fine, assuming SCHIP is reauthorized at the proper funding levels, and that's a whole other question. That, although I am fairly confident that this Congress will significantly exceed the president's funding levels for SCHIP, and that we'll be all right. Now, then we launched into the second phase, which I think Diane said was called Prescription for Pennsylvania. And Prescription for Pennsylvania has 2 important components. And in the interest of time, I'm only going to talk about one. But let me tell you that one I'm not going to touch on directly is our cost containment package. And it is, in the long run, absolutely essential. If all we do is extend coverage to the 770,000 Pennsylvanians who don't have it, we were at about 1 million before Cover All Kids. Covering all kids drops us down to about 770,000 adults, where actually the pathetic news is that at almost 750,000 people without health insurance, we're the 7th best state in the union in terms of percentage of having our people covered. But if all we did was cover those 757, it would be a pyrrhic victory, but a Pyrrhic victory, because exploding healthcare costs, unrestrained healthcare costs, a system that doesn't come close to working at any level, a system with no transparency, a system with no pay for performance, that system will collapse. We can't afford to cover all of our citizens if we don't rein in costs, and rein in costs significantly. And the good news is, it's not rocket science. You can rein in cost. One example, and then I'll get to back to how we're going to cover all Pennsylvanians. But one example, hospitals in Pennsylvania are required to report cases of hospital infections and their costs to something called the Pennsylvania Healthcare Containment Council. In 2005, the last year we have full statistics for, hospitals reported 20,000 incidents of hospital-acquired infections, causing 1,500 deaths and costing $3.5 billion. Is that a cost of doing business for the healthcare system? Absolutely not. Hospitals in Scandinavia and some European countries have basically zeroed out hospital-acquired infections. And a few hospitals in the United States, including the Pittsburgh VA hospital, have done a great job in significantly reducing the frequency and therefore the cost of hospital-acquired infections. And it truly isn't rocket science. Just one example. The most prevalent and actually the most virulent form of hospital-acquired infections is something called MRSA. MRSA can be carried by any of us. In fact, in this room, there are probably 20 to 30 MRSA carriers. Most of us are autoimmune, meaning the MRSA doesn't affect ourselves. But we are a carrier, and we can spread the disease to people who are in more vulnerable conditions and can be afflicted with it. Most American hospitals do absolutely nothing to check and see if you're a MRSA carrier, and they put you in the general population, treat you like everybody else. At the Pittsburgh VA, no one gets admitted without being first tested to see if they're a MRSA carrier. It's an easy test. You swab the inside of a nostril or inside of a cheek. 2 hours later, you'll know whether the person is a MRSA carrier. If the person is a MRSA carrier, they, of course, get admitted, but there's a whole different protocol. Before the person reaches their room, someone takes red tape, red adhesive tape, and tapes around the bed. And no one is allowed, including immediate family members, no one's allowed to get closer to the patient than the red tape unless they're gowned, capped, gloved, and masked. Hospital personnel cannot go into the room unless, and that counts maintenance men, it counts food service delivery people, nurses, physician assistants, doctors themselves. No one can go in without being masked, gowned, gloved, capped, and those materials are all destroyed immediately upon leaving the room. The gown costs about 50 cents, the gloves about 6 cents, the mask about 9 cents, and the cap about 3 cents. Pittsburgh VA did a study of how many times people came in causing that equipment to be destroyed, and during an average hospital stay, it costs $144 to replace the mask, gloves, etc. $144. The average cost of a hospital stay in Pennsylvania is $31,000. The average cost of a hospital stay with a hospital-acquired infection is $181,000, meaning a hospital stay for a hospital-acquired infection costs $150,000. And looking at you, you're not a very old audience. I don't know if you remember the old Fram oil filler commercial, but you can pay me now $144, or you can pay me later $150,000. They've cut MRSA infections by over 50% at the Pittsburgh VA hospital. There's so many things in the delivery of healthcare that need to be cost-constrained, and the beauty of it is, the thing that's most exciting about it is, as we can contain and reduce costs, we're improving quality. We don't need to admit so many people for chronic care to hospitals. If we manage the disease better, we can keep them out of hospitals. It cuts dramatic amounts of money out of the cost of the medical care delivery system, and it improves the health of the patient. We don't need to do non-emergent care in emergency rooms. There are so many ways to do that better and more cheaply and faster, get better service for folks. So the cost containment side is crucial. any health care plan, universal health care access plan we develop in Pennsylvania or California or Massachusetts or Illinois or in the United States of America has to contain a cost containment provision. But let me shift to the part of prescription for Pennsylvania that is going to create universal access. And we call that, since we call the first cover all kids, we call this cover all Pennsylvanians, CAP. And CAP is based on the same general principle as cover all kids. We take the existing system and we allow the uninsured to buy in. Now, the uninsured in this case are employers. We did surveys, we identified that 78% of our uninsured are working in Pennsylvania. And most of them, the vast majority, about 7% of that 78% is self-employed. But most of them, 71%, work for employers. And the vast majority of them work for small businesses that are low-wage business. Small business, the federal definition, 50 employees or less. Low wage meaning the average salary is less than the median income in Pennsylvania. The median income in Pennsylvania is $42,000. So we designed, and again, we surveyed these small businesses over the 2 years. They said, the employers said, the ones that didn't offer health insurance, that they would be willing to offer a plan to their employees somewhere between $100 and $200 a month. If we could get a cost structure somewhere between $100 and $200 a month, they would be willing to offer health insurance to their employees. So we constructed a plan. It's a subsidized product where the employer would pay $170. It's only employee coverage. It's not family coverage, and I'll get to that in a second. But the employer pays $170 a month, infinitely cheaper than you can get in the private market. The employee would contribute somewhere between $10 and $70 a month based on the employee's overall family income and its percentage of poverty. The uninsured who don't work can buy in to the plan, again, for a monthly premium depending on where they stand. And the self-employed can buy in, and even, again, if you're self-employed and even if you exceed 300% of poverty, you buy in at our cost, which for this program is $248 a month. So, and again, infinitely better, about a third of what you could get, even a semblance of private insurance for if you were self-employed. And this plan is a good basic health care plan. Obviously, it has hospitalization, doctor's visits. It has prescription drug coverage, but only generics, and a full range of mental health, including substance abuse, are all covered in the plan. It has significant coverage for prevention and avoidance of more serious conditions. It has wellness options in it. It's a good basic plan. An excellent basic plan. Now, how do we pay for it? Well, the employer-employee contribution, and by the way, statewide, this costs about $1.47 billion to fund. Employer-employee contributions add up to about 37% of the cost. The federal government, and we had our we've had two or three meetings with CMS, and they've been great. We think we are going to get everything we need, and that would be drawing down waivers for people 300% of poverty level or less. The federal government will wind up paying for about 33% of the plan. So when everyone says the states are reaching out and creating their own plans, understand there's no state that's done this without federal participation. They're joint plans. The state itself would pay for 23% of the plan, and we're paying for that in three ways. We're increasing our tobacco tax, our cigarette tax, about 11 cents a pack. We are ending an aberration, and I've yet to get a straight answer. I've been there for 4.5 years. Yet to get a straight answer as to why Pennsylvania is the only state in the union that doesn't tax cigars and smokeless tobacco products, where we are now. And those two are the main sources of income. Plus, we are redirecting funding streams We have a small program called Adult Basic Care ABC, which covers about 40,000 Pennsylvanians who are now going to be eligible for Coverall Pennsylvanians. So that stream is going to go into the funding mix. And as we cover more and more of the uninsured, our payments to the hospitals for uncompensated care will be redirected to this program itself. And then that leaves 7%. And this 7% is the most controversial of all. And it is the free rider or the health care assessment, whatever you want to call it. It's what companies who do not offer health care pay if they choose to continue to not offer health care. And this has no limitation. It goes to the smallest companies up to the largest companies. And we set it at 3%. I was on a program in New York last week with Governor Schwarzenegger. Governor Schwarzenegger was joining us by video conference. And I fessed up that we waited to see what California was setting its assessment at. They set it at 4%. So for political reasons, we set ours at 3%. So we could say to our businesses, look, we're so much better than California. But I want to give you an example of how that works and the choices that a small business person would make. Let's assume you have a metal shop. You have 10 employees. And you haven't been able to afford to give your employees health care. It's a problem for you. One, there's a fairly significant absenteeism rate because they're not very healthy. And two, your best employees leave as soon as they can find a company that does offer health care. They leave. So you're looking into this, and your average salary is $30,000. To put 10 employees into our plan, you'd pay $170 a month for 12 months. Let's rough it off at $2,000. And let's say for 10 employees, it will cost you $20,000 to provide health care for them. Now, if you choose to continue to not provide health care, and by the way, these employees could buy in to cover all Pennsylvanians if you choose not to do this. But if you choose not to do it, and it would depend on their family circumstances, it would depend on a lot of things. If you choose not to do it, you would pay a 3% payroll tax. Your payroll is $300,000. 3% of that would be $9,000. So the difference for a year is $11,000. And we believe, again, from our survey, we believe that most employers will opt to take the subsidized product. Because for the difference of $11,000, they can ensure that their best employees stay with them. The rate of employees coming and going is much lower for firms that offer health insurance than those who don't. They get to hold on to their better employees. Absentee rates are significantly lower as well. So we think for that small differential, it's going to be much lower. The biggest challenge politically for us in Harrisburg is the fair share assessment. Because businesses who don't offer health insurance, and there are plenty of them in Pennsylvania, are barking to their legislators, and their legislators are hearing that. What we need to make it successful, and what I set up in New York, and there was a group of some of the biggest companies in America, most of whom have Pennsylvania operations, we need the companies who do offer health care to say, hey, to the legislature, we're paying for the ones who don't. And they are. Uncompensated care. The uninsured get treated. You know that. And they get treated in the most expensive venue, emergency rooms, and the cost gets passed on to all of us. It is estimated by different foundations and people who have looked at this that the cost to Pennsylvania businesses is $1.2 billion a year, which roughs out to 6.2% of their premiums go to paying for uncompensated care. So if we covered all Pennsylvanians, every company's premium should drop by 6% or more. Every company's premiums. And so we need politically not only the advocacy organizations and citizens groups, we need business who cares about this. We need businesses to weigh in and say, it has to happen. And you've listened to them. Now listen to us. We're the good guys who do provide health care, and it has to happen. And my message to business is that, one, you've got to get on the stick and make this happen. Two, you need something to change because the cost of providing health care is killing American businesses, particularly those who compete in the global marketplace, who have a significant chunk of their bottom line going to health care, and their foreign competitors have zero we need to change that, and we need to change it rapidly. And my message to all the business folks and to the chamber folks and to my Republican colleagues in the legislature is, I believe healthcare is coming. You know, politics is a wonderful business. It is lobbyist-dominated in Washington, lobbyist-dominated in Harrisburg, until the tidal wave comes. And when the tidal wave comes, it sweeps everything aside. I was a trial lawyer. I was actually the district attorney, but I have a lot of friends who are trial lawyers. And when I ran for governor in 2001, I started my campaign. I said to the trial lawyers, get out there and work to have tort reform that you can live with, because it's coming. And you better get ahead of the curve. And their message to me was, now, through campaign contributions, we have the Republicans and Democrats in the Senate and in the House under control. We don't need to do that. We've got them under control. We can beat back any effort. Well, in 2002, medical malpractice insurance went up 90% in Pennsylvania. And the tidal wave came. And on a key vote, I won't bore you with the particulars, in the Senate of Pennsylvania, where the trial lawyers believed they had both sides locked up, they lost 41-7. 41-7. If the tidal wave comes, and I believe it will if we don't do something, it may be, from business' standpoint and from our standpoint, it may be the worst of all potential alternatives. And I'm not saying single payer is, but they may wind up, wake up one morning and find they've got single payer with all of the alleged problems that single payer has. So my message is, we can do it now. And we've got to do it in the state level. And let me close, and then I'm happy to take questions. Let me close by saying that if we're looking to build a national program, can we do it this way with states taking shared responsibility with the federal government? I think the answer is yes, with a caveat. If Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, California, Illinois are successful, and they join with Vermont and Maine to have good workable programs that come close to universal access, or if not universal access, at least offer an affordable product to every citizen. If we come close, I think other states will begin to replicate what we're doing. And if the federal government continues to cooperate, and one of the things that I thought was highly encouraging in the President's State of the Union speech was his taking notice of the states that are doing that and saying they would help. They choose an odd way to help. They would redirect the money that goes to the hospitals for uncompensated care now to us, and we've turned down that money because it would be robbing Peter to pay Paul right now. But the attitude at CMS clearly reflects the Bush administration's willingness to make these state programs work. So you could fashion a patchwork of state programs, but there are two caveats to that. To make it really work and truly constrain cost, in my judgment, first, the federal government has to pony up big time for a totally interoperable healthcare technology system. Every American should carry in their wallet a card, just like a credit card, that can be plugged into a computer and will demonstrate their entire medical history. So if they're in an accident in Cincinnati and they're from Philadelphia, the surgeons won't have to guess if there are any allergies. If they need a CAT scan, surgeons will be able to say, oh my gosh, I had a CAT scan 10 days ago at Jefferson Hospital, and they'll be able to bring up the results of the CAT scan at Jefferson. So many things. And again, cost saving, patient safety at the same time. Improvements in patient safety, reduction in cost. But that, in my judgment, and again, I've read a lot about this, and you probably know more than I do, somewhere between $100 and $125 billion up front nationally. Only the federal government can do something on that magnitude. And it's a one-time expenditure that I am told would save $30 to $40 billion a year in the delivery of health care in this country. The federal government's got to find a way to do that. Maybe some matching program with providers, but they've got to find a way to do that. And secondly, even with these frameworks that we've created, to really drive down the cost, and we believe, and again, Rx for PA, if you Google Rx for PA, you'll see our whole plan, and you'll see all the cost containment measures. But, and we believe we can really constrain costs, certainly slow down growth and maybe even actually reduce the overall costs. But I think the other role for the federal government in all of this would have some form of stop loss. And as you recall, John Kerry, that was, I thought, the single best idea that came out of the Kerry campaign, that we all know what drives the system is the high cost for a small number of people. And if the federal government would take over most of the cost after a certain level of expenditure, that would dramatically reduce the cost to American business. And I think if you did that, those two things, and those are not minor things, but if you did those two things and more states followed the states that are going down this road, I think you could have a workable system of national health insurance, which would be good for American business, good for Americans, and improve all that we do. And again, I would urge you, and I know a lot of advocates don't like to hear cost containment or cost savings, because they immediately associate that with a reduction in quality. The beauty of this is the cost savings and increase in the quality of healthcare delivery are synonymous. And with that, I'll stop and happy to answer any questions that you have.
Governor, your assertion, and I completely agree, and I support you in it.
Where are you?
Hi.
Oh, there you are. Good.
You've got bright lights in your face. The concept of trying to get people, have the federal government pay for some of the high-end costs and also capture people before they become really expensive, I think is absolutely central to the cost and quality connection.
No question.
And in order to do that, you have to incentivize folks, whether it's providers, employers, and individuals, to stay in the inexpensive category of health care. What do you plan to do? What's built into the Pennsylvania system to do that?
Well, we're asking the legislature to give the insurance commissioner a whole slew of new regulatory powers, including rate setting over health insurance costs, number one. But number two, the power to force a different form of payment. For example, I'm sure many of you are aware of the Wagner model for treating chronic care disease. It's a team approach. And let's take diabetes, the easiest to understand. The Wagner model has a nutritionist, a pharmacist, a physician assistant, maybe a certified nurse practitioner, and the primary care physician, who may turn out to be the least important person in that team approach. And the Wagner team approach, the difference is, in Pennsylvania, if you're suffering from symptoms, you go into your doctor examines you, tests you, and says, finds out you're a borderline diabetic. So your doctor will spend maybe 20 minutes with you after the tests are back. He'll hand you a pamphlet about nutrition. He'll hand you a pamphlet about how to administer the test, wish you well and say, you got to do this. It's important. You know, you don't want to come back with more severe symptoms. And you leave the doctor's office. You don't like the diet. So you go off it in 3 days. Or the first test you administer to test yourself is too painful. You stop doing it. Nobody ever hears about that. And the next time you see your doctor, it's when you're admitted to the hospital to get your leg amputated because you become a severe diabetic. The team approach, that nutritionist spends an hour with you planning your diet. And then that nutritionist calls you every week or 10 days. Hey, Mrs. Smith, how are you doing? How's the diet? Can you live with it? Do you need some adjustments, etc.? The physician's assistant demonstrates and tells you how to administer the test to yourself. And she'll call you a week later. Hey, Mrs. Smith, how are you doing? How's the test? Oh, it's painful, so you stopped it? Well, you should try this one then. There's another alternative you can do. And you manage the disease. The pharmacist participates. Everybody manages the disease to hold that Mrs. Smith at the borderline diabetic status so she doesn't become a severe diabetic. We can't do that in Pennsylvania right now. Our HMOs only pay for primary care physicians. We're so wacky that nurse practitioners are treated as specialists, so to visit a nurse practitioner is more expensive than visiting your primary care physician. And nurse-run clinics, because of the way the HMO payment structure is, Nurse-run clinics are more expensive than a visit to the emergency room. When truth be told, they should be infinitely less expensive. So we have to use what are hopefully our new regulatory powers to force these changes in the way our HMOs. And by the way, so far we're getting pretty good cooperation from the HMOs. So we may be able to do most of this in a cooperative fashion. In the end, it helps them. Going to a nurse-run clinic is infinitely cheaper than going to an emergency room for non-emergent care, and they should want to incentivize that. So we're working on changing those structures as well. But there's one other thing that we bring to bear, in addition to getting the legislative power or regulatory power to do it. We are the 800-pound gorilla. Pennsylvania, the state of Pennsylvania, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, we pay for 20% of the people that have HMO insurance in the state of Pennsylvania. We pay for 20%. One of the things we are going to do, if we don't get the action we need legislatively, or maybe even if we do to supplement it, is we're going to get the 500 biggest payers other than us in a room together and say, guess what? We're going to send them a message. We ain't paying for hospital-acquired infections anymore. We're not paying. We represent 55% of the clients of the HMOs. We're not paying. And they should send that message to the hospitals. You would see hospitals much more involved in trying to deal with HAIs if people stop paying for them. And by the way, that's not such a foreign concept. I think you're all probably in the healthcare delivery system business of some sort. I don't suppose we have any printers here. But if you were a printer and your ink supplier called you one day and said, oh, I have this brand new ink. It's wonderful. You said, okay, send me a batch. He sends you a batch. You print your first materials with it, and it's too blurry. And you call him up and say, this ink is too blurry. Send me the old batch. Sends you the old batch. At the end of the month, a bill comes in charging you for the old batch and for the new batch that wasn't any good. Do you think that business will pay for both? Not on your life. It will never happen. And yet, we, through the providers, routinely pay for stuff that we shouldn't be paying for. Mary Smith, that borderline diabetic who's now a full-fledged diabetic because we don't pay for managing her disease, she goes into the hospital to have her right leg amputated. The hospital screws up, they amputate her left leg. We pay for the amputation of the left leg, the incorrect leg. Then the left leg has to be rehabilitated, including the prosthesis. We pay for the rehabilitation of the amputation of the incorrect leg. And then the correct leg has to be amputated, and they do that, and we pay. Pay three times. Three times. No other business would come close to doing that. No other business. We've created, if we sat down and wanted to create the worst type of healthcare delivery system in the world, where the consumer has no stake in the game, where there's no transparency, where there's no pay for performance, where we pay for visits to a doctor rather than outcomes, well, we've done it. We Americans who are pride ourselves being the most innovative and most inventive and have the best systems in the world, we've created the worst system. We pay the most for health care and get results worse than most other developed nations in the world. Canada pays about half of what we do per capita and has much better infant mortality rates, diabetic mortality rates, you name it. How do we let this happen? How do we let this happen? It's the world turned crazy. Anybody ever watch a 78-year-old woman go to the grocery store? She often will take a magnifying glass with her so she can see the item pricing on the shelves. And then when she checks out, she stands at the end of the counter, takes every item out of the bag, checks it against the receipt to make sure that she's not being charged for an item that isn't in the bag. Yet, she'll leave a hospital, never look at the bill. She may never even get a bill. We've managed to take every inherent cost savings that exists, cost saving protection that exists in other forms of endeavor. We managed to take them out of the system. Pennsylvania, in the last 7 years, healthcare premiums went up 75.6%, inflation went up 17%, median wages went up 13%. Another 7 years of that, ladies and gentlemen, and healthcare as we know it in Pennsylvania will be over. Over. So that's why the corp, please, if you have the time, check RX for PA and see about the whole plan, because the whole plan is important as well as increasing access. Yes, sir.
Hi, I'm Chris Lee with the Washington Post. You talked about the Pittsburgh VA and what they're doing in the way of acquiring gowns and gloves and how they've reduced their hospital-acquired
the protocol.
I think you said about 50%. So governments routinely require food handlers to follow certain standards. Will your government require hospitals to take up measures like they've done in Pittsburgh? And if not, why not?
First, let me tell you that the good news is that the VA, Jim Nicholson, has ordered that the other 186 Veterans Administration hospitals follow the Pittsburgh VA's protocol. That's good news nationwide. We're absolutely trying to get through our, again, legislation or regulation, get those protocols made mandatory. But one thing I'm going to insist on, and even if we don't succeed with the legislature, I'm going to insist on progress in reducing hospital-acquired infections as a condition for relicensing. Simple as that. I don't care if it's the University of Pennsylvania Hospital. If they are not making progress in reducing the number of incidents and the cost of HIAs, we're going to, and, you know, it may be shockwaves when all of a sudden, you know, we suspend a major hospital's license, but I intend to do that. I mean, hospitals have to understand we're serious. I visited the Pittsburgh VA, and, you know, the greatest thing about it is everybody had bought in. Dealing and reducing hospital-acquired infections was a mission for them. The most incredible experience was when the maintenance guy took us. We were on one of the surgical floors. The maintenance guy took us around, and he took us into his storeroom. And he said, I don't leave the hospital at night until I am certain that there are enough gowns, enough masks, so that no doctor is going to have an excuse or no one's going to have an excuse that, oh, I didn't do it because there weren't available masks and gowns. And he said it with such great pride. He was saving not only tons of money, 1,500 people died in Pennsylvania last in 2005 from hospital-acquired infections. They bought in. Too many hospitals today, and our great hospitals. We're blessed in Pennsylvania to have great teaching hospitals, some of the best in the world. Too many of them look at the cost of hospital-acquired infections as the cost of doing business. You know, it happens. You know, stuff happens. Well, stuff doesn't have to happen. And surgeons, as well as food service delivery people and maintenance men, should be interested in curbing hospital-acquired infections.
Hi, Governor. My name is Ann Kamsky. I'm with SEIU. We applaud your leadership in Pennsylvania on this. This is going big, going bold. This is terrific from our perspective. I thought you were going to say, though, in terms of needing help from the federal government, I'm curious about your employer responsibility piece and whether you feel like you've crafted it to fit the ERISA issue,
yeah,
or whether you need help from the feds in that regard.
I don't mean to be at all patronizing, but do people understand that? There's a real ERISA problem with, or a potential ERISA problem with forcing employers to do this. We think we've crafted it that way. We looked at the Maryland experience and built off the Maryland experience. But who knows how the courts are going to eventually decide. And it would be great to get an amendment to ERISA to make this possible. Maryland got caught up because it was a lousy statute to begin with, you know, almost a punitive statute. If we were to lose that issue, I think I would seek help. And I've already talked to Senator Spector about the idea, and he understands it. So I think we could. You're absolutely right. We probably should seek clarification now, but we think we've crafted it in a way that avoids the ERISA problems. But you're probably right. Because this doesn't work. And by the way, we have all sorts of go-bare periods to make sure that employers don't dump and stuff. But this doesn't work without employer participation one way or the other. And if there's no employer participation, if we're not going to have that universal health care assessment, then these guys are going to wake up one day and it's going to be single payer. And I'm not saying that that's necessarily a bad result, but I just think in the current political climate vis-a-vis taxing and spending, it's going to be a tough result. But when that tidal wave hits, you know, you can't spit into the wind and you can't tug on Superman's cape. And when the tidal wave comes, you can't hold it back. You can't hold it back. And, you know, I hate to think that only a tidal wave can cause us to act as Americans. In the single most severe domestic problem we have, we should be responsible and we should be proactive and deal with this problem ourselves. But that's actually a good suggestion. Maybe we should revisit that now and get the ball rolling. A couple more, and then I've got to hit the road. Or did we do such a good job that...
I just wanted to hear a little bit more about your thoughts about how to organize the business community. Small business, the advocates across the country are organizing small business, and they're hungry for something for solutions. They really want to give their people health care.
I believe that.
But then there are the big ones, and who are also hurting, but they're not talking. And it seems like only the governor's offices can bring the weight to and the influence to do something about this. So what are your thoughts?
I think the key to getting the bigger businesses who hold the key politically involved is the cost containment part of it. It's absolutely crucial because they want to continue to offer health care if they can. They want to continue to offer health care, but they need to see results. They can't go through the next 7 years and have health care premiums go up 75% while inflation goes up 17%. So the cost containment part of it. And by the way, legislatively, if you had asked me, what are your chances legislatively of getting all this through? I think we'll get some form of universal access through because the people want it. And the legislature knows that. And they know if I hit the road, and I've hit the road a little bit to campaign for this, but if I hit the road, I can really beat them up on this. So they'll do something. And I think we'll have some form of universal access. It may well be that to avoid small business wrath, they just find another source of revenue to pay for that 7%, but it still doesn't work over the course of time because there's no disincentive for businesses eventually going bare. But they may try to do something along those lines. But the key on the cost-saving initiatives, you know, when the plan came out, I've been in this business for 30 years. I've been an elected official for 30 years, and I love my business, but it is a hoot. The plan comes out, and everybody says, oh, the governor's plan is wonderful, it's visionary, etc. Now, what's going to happen in Harrisburg when we get close to voting is that different organizations, they will all remain nameless, but they're all not innocent. Different organizations will send their lobbyists up. But the lobbyists will say, oh, we love the governor's plan. It's a great plan. But there's 3% of it that affects us. Can you cut that out? Then the next group comes up and says, oh, the governor's plan is visionary. But there's 5% that affects us. Can you cut that out? And by the time the lobbyists for the 6 or 7 organizations have come up, if the legislature, as is its tendency, yields to their wishes, 40% of the plan is gone. It's emasculated. And that's where the toughness, because cost containment isn't as sexy as universal access. But in the long run, it's equally important in my judgment. But that's where the big businesses come in. I forget the conference I spoke. I know Anna Berger was there and Andy Stern was there. It was actually a conference. It's an organization where Andy is one of the co-chairs. And believe it or not, and Andy has gotten a great deal of grief on this, the other co-chair is Lee Scott, the CEO of Walmart. But it's not just Walmart, General Mills, Verizon. I mean, big, big, giant companies are involved. And that's the key, to get those giant companies active in the legislature, in all of the legislatures. That's the key. Simple as that. Let me take that one lady in the back, and then I better hit the road.
Linda Hombrook from the Maternal and Child Health Bureau. One of the things you mentioned was that there is more to care than health insurance. And one of the tsunamis that is out there is the health care shortage. particularly with pediatric subspecialists.
Right.
And I'm wondering if you could address how your plan will
address
that shortage.
There's a lot of shortages in the healthcare delivery system. And I think one of the ways to address the shortages, and one of the things we do, is to empower our non-physician healthcare professionals to practice to the full extent of their training. It's absolutely crucial. We are losing primary care physicians in rural areas. And it's not like we're losing primary care physicians in America. And in our plan, we are increasing the reimbursement levels to primary care physicians through our Medicaid program. But we are losing primary care physicians. One of the ways that we can fill the gap, not entirely, but fill the gap, is through nurse practitioner clinics, federally qualified health clinics run by nurse practitioners in rural areas and in hours that aren't normally covered. I mean, we build a healthcare delivery system that's open from 8 to 4:30, Monday through Friday. Anything happens to you any other time, you're out of luck. You know, if it's a severe emergency, you'll get treated. But anything else, you're out of luck. You have to wait in an emergency room for 5 hours and pay the highest possible cost. So by opening up the door to allow these healthcare professionals, non-physician healthcare professionals, to practice up to the capabilities of what they can do, that's going to fill a lot of the gaps. That's number one. Number two, for pediatrics, for OBGY and gynecology, understand the reason that you're seeing so many obstetric wards close, it's not because of medical malpractice. It's because there's very little profit in it. And it's a loser. For most hospitals, it's a loser. It's only the biggest hospitals who are going to have tremendous frequency that still make money on it. And you're going to need some form of government intervention. There's no question in my mind. The reason I know it's not related to, the closures are not related to medical malpractice, is because we have had a lot of closures in Pennsylvania, particularly in southeastern Pennsylvania, of obstetric wards. We have had, since I became governor, I came in at the height of that medical malpractice crisis. We have spend $220 million a year in cigarette tax money to abate a portion of, not a portion, 100% of physicians' responsibilities to pay into, in Pennsylvania, physicians pay for two types of insurance, $500,000 for primary care from a private carrier, $500,000 into the state for catastrophic insurance. We have abated for the last 4 years surgeons, neurosurgeons, orthopods, and OBGYNs. We've abated their responsibility to buy the other $500,000. We pay for it. The $220 million of cigarette tax money goes into the fund as opposed to the $220 million that would come out of the doctor's hand. And in most cases, of course, the hospitals pay for the doctors anyway. Nonetheless, it hasn't stopped the closure of obstetrics. And by the way, that's worth, for an obstetrician in southeast Pennsylvania, it's worth about $35,000 a year. There's no state in the union that has taken that nut off a doctor's medical malpractice. And we're still experienced. They're just losers for hospitals. And it may well be that we're going to have to use our regulatory power to make sure that there's some geographic coverage of obstetrics. But I think the long-run key is to allow those non-physician trained professionals. I mean, have any of you seen the training that nurse practitioners get? I mean, it's incredible. Nurse midwives, I mean, incredible. Certified nurse midwives. And we don't allow them in Pennsylvania and in most states, we don't allow them to come close to practicing to the full scope of their training or their abilities. And that will increase access dramatically, dramatically. Well, thank you all very, very much. And let me say, the foundation, which does such wonderful work, obviously keep it up. It's a godsend. And all of you who care so much about this issue, although I believe it will be business that will finally tip the scales, we who care so much about it have to keep the pressure on, too. We have to reach the annoyance quotient, and we're not there yet. We're not there yet. We got minimum wage passed in Pennsylvania because we finally reached the annoyance quotient. And we're not there yet on health care. We should be, given the public's concern about it. But we're not there yet, so keep it up. Thank you all.
I think we should give the governor another round of applause for his leadership and his vision. And certainly, if we wanted to be inspired to move forward in this discussion of what states can do and how they can help inform the federal debate, we couldn't have asked for a better start with Governor Rendell's keynote address. We are at a point where it is very crucial that we look, as he said, at the annoyance factor as we try to keep reminding people that our job is not done in terms of trying to ensure America's children, as well as move on to the bigger challenges of the adult uninsured population. And today we're really pleased that we're going to be able to probe a little more deeply. We started on the East Coast in Pennsylvania with the governor, and we're going to move across the country today from the South to Louisiana and out to California to really learn some of the lessons about what states have been trying, what has been successful. And I'm very pleased that on our panel today we're going to have Nicole Ravenel, the president and CEO of the Southern Institute on Children and Families, that has been a leader in focusing attention on barriers to coverage and promoting strategies to improve coverage of children and families. She's going to discuss the progress that the southern states have made in reaching uninsured children over the past decade and highlight some of the examples of approaches that work. Ruth Kennedy, the Deputy Director of Medicaid in the state of Louisiana, which has experienced its own tidal wave, unfortunately, but clearly had begun to put in place many of the strategies for covering children in that southern state. And Ruth has worked tirelessly on coverage of children in Louisiana, and it was one of the proud pieces of coverage there that their uninsured rate for children has actually gone down over the years instead of continuing to climb and rate high. And finally, we're going to conclude with Kristen Golden Testa, the director of the California Health Program, the Children's Partnership. Kristen worked on health policy on the staff of the Finance Committee at the creation of SCHIP, so she saw the birth and hopefully will see the reauthorization of the program. The Children's Partnership focuses on the goal of securing health care coverage for uninsured children and has taken a leadership role in promoting the use of technology, which the governor pointed out was so important to improve the health of America's children. She's going to talk about both tools to expedite enrollment of children and about California's efforts to cover all children. And we think that it's very important to note that we have made great progress, and over the last decade we've gone from covering very few children over the years, 20 million children on Medicaid, sort of stable by 1998. And with the implementation of the SCHIP program and with expansions of Medicaid to complement SCHIP, we now see an incredible growth in the number of children who are receiving their health care coverage through either Medicaid or the SCHIP program. But we shouldn't forget that as we cover children, it's important to keep in mind that we haven't covered all children. As this slide shows, the percentage of low-income children without health insurance has declined, but in 2005, 14% of low-income children were still uninsured. Now, we know that insurance matters, and as the governor pointed out, access to care and improvements in health care for those with insurance are much easier to obtain. There are fewer barriers to getting care, fewer delays, and as this graphic and all the research of the last year shows, that unmet need and lack of coverage is really a problem for the uninsured. And I think one of the points that we like to make here, which relates to both the SCHIP program and Medicaid, is the importance for children of dental coverage. And dental coverage has been one of the areas that has been poorly reimbursed under Medicaid, where there have been some problems in the past, and which now is a very important component of comprehensive care for low-income children. Yet, despite all of the progress, 1 in 10 children under 19 in America are uninsured. And as we travel across the country and looking at progress, you can see that in 14 states, more than 11% of children are uninsured. And I think that those states include California, which obviously is going to make a big effort. Pennsylvania is making its effort in the middle, as is Louisiana. And we want to learn what makes a difference in bringing down the uninsured rates for children. And one of the issues, of course, is that while many children are eligible for Medicaid and SCHIP, they're not yet enrolled. And so one of the big focuses here today will be on what can we do to reach those eligible but uninsured children and bring them into the coverage that's affordable to them. Clearly, one of the measures that we've seen improvements in over the past few years is that higher eligibility levels for Medicaid and SCHIP have enabled states to have more children that they can reach and bring into coverage, yet eligibility levels alone don't bring children into enrollment. And what we've been looking at across the country is the importance of state efforts to both eliminate the barriers to enrollment, eliminate the asset tests, some of the extensive documentation, the interviews at enrollment, and to provide better ways to keep children enrolled so that they don't go off the back end when you bring them in the front end. And so continuous eligibility and presumptive eligibility, keeping children enrolled over the retention period, and then really simplifying the forms and the materials that parents have to fill out. I remember when we first started the Medicaid Commission in 1991, one of our favorite slides that we got from Sarah Shrupshine, the predecessor to Nicole at the Southern Institute on Children and Families, was the documentation requirements that a family had to fill out to come in and be eligible for the Medicaid program. So that this has been a long struggle to simplify the eligibility process to be consumer-friendly and family-friendly, and I know we're going to hear today about some of the state efforts to move forward in that dimension. We do hear that one of the barriers to care is that parents don't really want to enroll their children in public programs. We've done a number of focus groups around the country with parents who are both on the have children on the Medicaid and SCHIP program and parents who have children who remain uninsured. And what we find is that it's not that parents don't value health insurance coverage for their children. It's that they often have misperceptions about whether their children would be eligible for public coverage. They find some of the procedures that are still in place for enrollment to pose barriers to coverage. And in fact, we also know that by covering the parents, we may help get the children enrolled as well. So from our focus groups with parents, and you'll have those reports in your folder today, we really do see that it isn't a challenge of not valuing health insurance or wanting it. It's really a challenge of making it family-friendly and accessible and helping to get the message out to parents that their children are, in fact, potentially eligible for this program and should check out enrollment. And we do see from the governor and from others that states are moving on to implement their plans for universal coverage for children and building on that for broader coverage using a combination of approaches. And I think, as the governor so clearly pointed out, clearly, federal assistance and the federal contribution to these efforts is a critical cornerstone of all of the state reform efforts. And now we see that also as we move forward into the SCHIP reauthorization debate in the Congress, that the ability of states to maintain their coverage for children and to broaden their coverage beyond children is going to be very much reflective of how the federal government responds in terms of the funding and support and extension of the SCHIP program. And clearly, as we did a series of interviews with state CHIP directors, we learned that from the CHIP directors, their views are on the future of SCHIP and the debate before the Congress is extremely critical to state efforts to be able to build on. Without SCHIP, millions more children in low-income working families would be uninsured. They note it's kind of you pay now or you pay later, as the governor said. Inadequate health care for children has long-term consequences. Coordination between SCHIP and Medicaid helps to make sure that no one falls through the cracks. It's a myth that there's enough money to go around. Clearly, the cry for more assistance from the federal government to be able to strengthen the partnership and to be able to find stable funding so that the states can move forward. So these are the issues that are before us today as the Congress moves forward to look at the reauthorization. And I'm pleased that our panel is going to be able to offer you their insights from the states and to give you hopefully some ways that can help inform the federal debate over the reauthorization of SCHIP and the future of coverage for children. So with that, I'll turn it over to Nicole to start our conversation.
Thank you, Diane. I'm pleased, good morning, and I'm pleased to be here to talk about the issue of public health coverage for children and opportunities and challenges. We've certainly come a long ways since the authorization of the SCHIP legislation. There are few more compelling issues than the issue of ensuring that children are not denied health coverage because of their families' inability to pay for that health care. It is good and sound public policy in order for us to obtain and get children health care coverage. We've seen research has shown over and over that good health care results in long-term good health. The Southern Institute on Children and Families focuses on improving the well-being of children and families through knowledge, leadership, and action. And a key strategy to this improvement is in helping families and children obtain access to public benefits such as Medicaid and SCHIP for which they are eligible for. The Southern Institute, we direct programs in nationally, regionally, statewide, and locally, but we have a special focus on the Southern region. Here, as you can see, that is depicted as 17 Southern states and the District of Columbia. Why focus on the South? If you look at any indicator of child well-being, many of the Southern states perform poorly. 13 Southern states and the District of Columbia have a higher percentage of children living in poverty than the nation as a whole. While only 38% of all children in the U.S. reside in these 17 Southern states and the District of Columbia, 45% of those children who are uninsured resides in the Southern region. And we have 9 Southern states in the District of Columbia whose children in fourth grade perform at lower levels, reading levels, than the rest of the nation. As a region, the South deserves special attention, especially in the area of health coverage. Prior to the passage of SCHIP in 1997, there were 11 million uninsured children, with 5 million of them estimated to be eligible for Medicaid, which in most states in that country at the time was not a generous program. Applying for Medicaid felt more like being on trial and was often described as demeaning for families, primarily due to excessive requirements and poor interactions at the local eligibility offices. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation decided to set enrollment into Medicaid as a priority for that particular foundation. They sought the expertise of my colleagues, Sarah Sheptrine and Dr. Vicki Grant, because of the groundbreaking research that they had performed in the South that showed that more individuals were denied coverage for procedural reasons, such as failure to return a pay stub, than that they were found ineligible for those programs. While the foundation's initial commitment was to work with a small number of states, the passage of SCHIP in the summer of 1997 presented an opportunity to invest additional research resources to work in all states and the District of Columbia. The goal of that initiative was to reduce the number of uninsured children and adults who are eligible for Medicaid and SCHIP but weren't enrolled, to improve eligibility processes to facilitate the enrollment and renewal processes, and to build knowledge and experience to achieve these benefits and to retain them for the long term. The accomplishments, what have we seen? And today I'm pleased to share with you all a report that the Covering Kids and Families Initiative has just released regarding our promising practices, what we have learned from this single national effort to ensure that eligible children and families get enrolled in these programs. But what we've seen is that there's now a knowledgeable network of people across the country on this issue of healthcare coverage. There are more public and private entities engaged in the effort of getting children healthcare coverage. There's better coordination between Medicaid and the SCHIP program. Instead of seeing them as being our adversaries, we're now partners with state eligibility agencies. There are more progressive policies that Diane just shown that enacted to simplify the application and renewal processes. In the southern region, we see that 15 out of the 18 southern states, including D.C., have eligibility levels at 200% of the federal poverty level or greater. 16 of the southern states have eliminated the asset test, which is a counterproductive public policy that prevents families from maintaining work and having the resources to afford to have their child access health care coverage. 15 out of the 18 southern states have eliminated the face-to-face interview, which again is a barrier to the enrollment process. And 9 of the 18 southern states, including D.C., have continuous eligibility, which help those children to maintain health care coverage once they get enrolled. We're seeing an increased availability of applications, increased application assistance. Now this process is more dignified for many families. There's an increased awareness of Medicaid and SCHIP availability for families. This was provided to us by the Oregon Department of Human Services when they reviewed their eligibility process and found that they were touching applications 72 times prior to making a decision on eligibility. Those were not beneficial steps in the process of determining eligibility. They streamlined their processes, and now they have this as a process. In addition, we've seen successful strategies for enrollment. For instance, and these are all highlighted in the publication that we've just released, Pennsylvania is using a web-based application system to support its simplification efforts. Combining that with a call-in number, 800 number, they're assisting families to complete applications via the phone and through the web. Iowa uses an automated referral process between Medicaid and SCHIP to ensure that children don't lose their coverage. Many of these families, their incomes fluctuate, and so they move from eligibility category between Medicaid and SCHIP. It is critical that we continue to coordinate eligibility processes between these two programs to ensure that families do not, particularly children, lose their eligibility. And of course, Louisiana, who's always our poster child for successful enrollment processes, which Ruth will talk about more, has used simplified eligibility processes, including performing ex parte reviews, to facilitate the enrollment and renewal of eligible children. What we've seen in the southern region is that 10 southern states and D.C. realized a reduction in uninsured. Some of these are tremendously reduced their number of uninsured between 1999 and 2004. While we've made great strides in reducing the number of uninsured and in simplifying our processes for public enrollment and public health coverage, there is more to be done. As states have become successful at reaching those uninsured children who were eligible for SCHIP and Medicaid, additional resources are needed to ensure that those states can continue to provide coverage to those who are eligible for those programs. While the word is out, more needs to be done to raise awareness of the availability of Medicaid and SCHIP for those families who are working and believe that they may not qualify. We need to continue to improve on the eligibility process, especially in the renewal area. And retention. We have done an adequate job of simplifying the application process. Now the renewal process can use some attention. While most states with separate SCHIP programs have a joint application, we see fewer of them using a joint renewal form. States are picking up the gauntlet, as you've heard Governor Rendell speak earlier, and proposing initiatives to expand eligibility or to help facilitate the enrollment of those children who are eligible for current programs but not enrolled. But we can see that there's much more that can be done together, both at the federal level and the state level, to ensure that children obtain coverage and maintain the coverage that they so deserve. Thank you.
Good morning. I appreciate the invitation to be here and to share what we've done in Louisiana over the past 8 years to improve health coverage for children and families, and to share with you what we have learned during that time working in the trenches. We've managed to dramatically reduce the percentage of uninsured children in our state. That slide that Nicole showed, that long yellow one, that was us on the far right. And concurrently, we've increased enrollment and improved the enrollment process for pregnant women and eligible parents as well. To get a full appreciation of the current things, the way that things are in Louisiana, it's important that you have some understanding of what Medicaid eligibility looked like in Louisiana before. In 1998, our Medicaid eligibility income limits for children and families were, shall we say, ultra-conservative, the absolute minimum allowable. And our application and enrollment process for Medicaid were a huge barrier. The application form itself was 16 pages long. As to verification requirements, one of our staff said we used to make families verify everything but the air in their tires. While we never went quite that far, in retrospect, we know that we asked for far more than was necessary. And at the time, we were also grappling with the unintended consequences of welfare reform. In a single year, we had lost 70,000 enrollees, 30,000 of them children. Our high rate of poverty in Louisiana, our large African American population, all further contributed to the number of uninsured. You can understand then why we had in 1998 the nation's third highest percentage of uninsured kids, or so we were continually told. And we now know that more than 200,000 of those children were eligible for our existing Medicaid programs and just not enrolled. With SCHIP, as you recall, states had the option to either expand their existing Medicaid program, create a separate state program, or a combination of both. Louisiana chose to implement SCHIP through an expansion of our traditional Medicaid program. And for us, to borrow from Robert Frost, that has made all the difference. Why? Because as a Medicaid expansion program, simplifying the application and enrollment and renewal processes for SCHIP equally benefited children from lower income families, those poor and near poor families who were eligible for Medicaid, and subsequently for pregnant women and parents. We employ the same application, verification, and renewal philosophy for parents that we have for children. One of the most family-friendly policies that we've done in the last 8 years was to eliminate the assets test for parents, which we did in 2002. With the low income threshold we have, the likelihood that someone would have resources to pay for their health care is extremely remote, and this has proven to be a very sound policy decision for us. Because of the simplification and improvements that we had made in our eligibility for parents, we were able to enroll thousands of them who had been displaced by Hurricane Katrina. Eligibility caseworkers went actually on site in more than 200 shelters throughout the state, assisting with application completion, enrolling many of those parents the same day or next day. In the first 4 months following Katrina, enrollment of parents in Medicaid from the New Orleans region was 37%. We saw a 37% increase. All new enrollees in our TANF program in Louisiana are automatically eligible for Medicaid without the need for a separate application form or verification. And in October, we began enrolling women, many of them parents, in our new Take Charge program, which covers family planning services for low-income women. In January 2003, we expanded Medicaid eligibility for pregnant women with income between 133% and 200% of the poverty level. We've also worked to shorten the application processing time for pregnant women. While federal Medicaid regulations consider any application processed in fewer than 45 days to be timely, we felt it was important to reduce the time between a pregnant woman applying for Medicaid and her actually getting approved. While we know that having a Medicaid card in hand doesn't ensure early prenatal care, we didn't want not having that Medicaid card to be the reason for delay or not getting first trimester prenatal care. One of the policy changes we've made is to allow self-declaration of pregnancy. States are given wide latitude to establish their own verification policies for SCHIP and Medicaid. In the 3 years since we made that policy change, we have not had a problem with women misrepresenting their situation to enroll in Medicaid, and we don't believe that it has compromised the integrity of our eligibility decisions. So many pregnant woman applications are now processed the very same day or next day. And on May 1st, we began enrolling non-citizen pregnant women not eligible for Medicaid using the SCHIP prenatal option. Since Hurricanes Katrina and Rita, our demographics in Louisiana are rapidly changing, and lack of prenatal care for Latino women had become a major concern. And last, but certainly not least, in a relatively short period of time, at least from a policy standpoint, we've witnessed a remarkable decrease in our percentage of uninsured children. Now, this is CPS data, not our home-cooked numbers here. In 1998, 31.6%, that's nearly one out of three low-income children in Louisiana lacked health insurance. When the updated data was released by the Census Bureau in August of 2006, that number had been reduced to 12.5%. And the overall percentage of uninsured children in Louisiana is even lower, single digits, 8%. To be perfectly frank, in 1998 and 99 and 2000, in fact, until August of 2005, we didn't know if we would ever see this day. When you consider the environment in which we were working, a poor southern state faced with major budget deficits at the time that most states had large surpluses, we think this is pretty remarkable. As someone who has been involved from day one, we would point to these factors as being the keys to our success. First and foremost is we've benefited from the political will and a legislative commitment to increase enrollment of uninsured children, whether they qualify for traditional Medicaid or for SCHIP, knowing that additional children translate to additional state match. And it's a given that simplification of the eligibility process is essential, but we learned very quickly that equal focus has to be placed on retention once that child has been enrolled. Otherwise, it's very much like trying to fill a bucket with a big hole in it. And finally, you can change your policies, but those new policies must be carried out by people. Those people are the eligibility caseworkers and managers at every level of our organization. But organizational change doesn't just happen. It has been hard work. One of our longtime supervisors summarized the changes that she has witnessed like this. She said the old way of thinking was that if they wanted the services, they should be expected to do the legwork. Now the caseworkers get forms completed and information verified themselves, which in the long run actually saves them time. But changing old habits has been a long, hard road to hoe. We've definitely witnessed a radical change in the culture of eligibility in our state, and we are far from finished. Part of Governor Blanco's legislative package is a bill that expands eligibility to uninsured children between 200 and 300% of poverty. She recently said that universal coverage for children is now on our sight. Incidentally, that bill was passed by our House Monday afternoon on a vote of 103 yeas and no nays, and so it's now going to the Senate. Not only will this bill expand eligibility to cover children who don't qualify now, but it includes funding and the adoption of policies like presumptive eligibility and express lane eligibility, contingent on express lane eligibility's approval by Congress, to enroll 24,000 additional, or about one-third of the remaining eligible but uninsured children next year. So we anticipate 8,000 children who don't currently qualify and 24,000 children who are eligible but not yet enrolled. Like most states, about 75% of the uninsured kids in Louisiana are already eligible for our existing programs. And we're preparing to implement the new Medicaid Optional Family Opportunity Act, which allows coverage for children with disabilities from higher income families. And yes, we are actively working to expand coverage for the hundreds of thousands of uninsured parents. In closing, merely enrolling more children and parents, even reducing that percentage of uninsured, is not our end game. But we do believe that health coverage is a prerequisite to access to health care, and ultimately quality health care will result in improved health status and quality of life for our citizens. Thank you.
Uh-oh, technology. Perhaps I shouldn't be the one talking about technology. Hello, I'm Kristen Golden-Testa. I'm going to be doing a little bit of cleanup here. I was going to talk a little bit about the trends, a little walk through the national trends on enrollment simplifications. We did a little bit of this, so I'm going to do a little bit more of a focus on where we're going and then share with you where we're going in California on larger reform as well as our efforts to cover all children. As you know, historically, the system has been set up so that it had been more of a, as you'd heard, a little bit more of a culture of making sure that you're ensuring that no child's getting in that shouldn't be, which then means that a lot of children that should be getting covered are not, and it's creating a system that's rather inefficient and cumbersome, not only for the system itself, but for the children. And those children that do get in obviously have a hard time staying, and you see an effect of churning. In California alone, originally, we started off with a 28-page application, which could perhaps be more of an autobiography from every single applicant than it is an application for health insurance. And it's currently, we're still seeing the effects of the churning of in California, which does cost a lot of money. We were spending about $120 million over 3 years just to re-enroll children that should never have lost coverage in the first place. So where we are now across the nation, we've really, as you've heard, picked up a lot of the simplifications that are offered in these programs so that we're making it easier for families. And I am proud to say that in California last year, we are now going to be doing self-certification, which from our perspective is an enormous coup because it took quite a lot of effort on our behalf to try and get the state there. They're going to start off with a pilot of that program and move statewide. So we're very excited about that. And I do think a catalyst here has been the SCHIP at the federal level, and I think it really kind of shows what the essential part has played of this federal and state partnership in this creation. At the federal level, at a bipartisan level, they said we really want to encourage the expansion and increased enrollment of more children. And states really stepped up to the plate. A lot of states had already been blazing that trail, but with the advent of SCHIP, it really pushed a lot of states to step up and really go beyond. And they've shown incredible successes and been great champions and doing things not only to expand enrollment, but really to look at how to find and enroll the children that are already eligible. In California, we also had stepped up and were covering children up to 250%, but we also pioneered some innovative enrollment strategies like express lane enrollment. An express lane enrollment is really based on the concept of expediting enrollment from where children are, where large numbers of children are. Around 70% of the uninsured children are already seen in other programs like WIC, school lunch, food stamps. So why not use those programs that have similar eligibility standards, use the information that you've already gotten from those families to start the enrollment process for health insurance. And this has been piloted in California through the school lunch program. We're also going to be doing it through the WIC program, as well as there's a prevention program in California that also, when children come in for their regular periodic screenings, they can enroll in health insurance that way as well. And we have some important lessons that we could talk about maybe in the discussion period about what could be applied to other states. As well as, and I'll talk about this later, there's some legislation, a Lugar-Bingaman bill, S-1213, that would create that type of flexibility for other states. Where we're going is clearly that technology is, except for my own use of it, apparently, but is sort of a key catalyst for how we can increase enrollment. And there's several exciting things. I mean, one, it means starting really a culture change and thinking about how technology can be used. But really, a lot of the technology is already out there and being used in other forms, but not really fully harnessed in the world of health insurance reform and enrollment. And it can be ranging from things like auto-enrollment and e-signatures that create efficiencies by taking the data that the state already has on a family rather than asking them to fill it out again. Program integrity through verification without having to ask for all sorts of information in addition from the family. And most importantly, also having the programs communicate within a state. A lot of times they're very siloed, and there's an opportunity through new technologies and middleware, don't ask me to go too deep into that, but things that can allow systems to talk across without having to make massive overhauls of any one of the particular programs. It's a way of a messenger, if you will, to communicate among different systems, as well as modernizing the legacy systems without having to totally redo them. Some examples, just a little nod to Governor Rendell's program. They have a Compass system that also Nicole referred to, where they can do e-enrollment, where families can enroll right online. If they have a computer at home, they can do it there. What I found was very impressive about it, for example, was that you can, when you renew, you just sort of look at the information they already have and you certify, yes, that's still true, rather than having to basically resubmit information when you're renewing your coverage. In California, as I mentioned, we have Express Lane that we're expanding. Our WIC program already has an electronic system that can communicate with our health insurance programs, so it just seems like a no-brainer to try and connect them for the purposes of the child enrolling in health insurance when they are signing up for WIC. And we also have our own electronic application, a Healthy app and a One app, which brings in many different programs, and so families can decide which programs they want to apply for online, and this system asks the questions that are relevant for those programs and then submits the information. One thing that we found was pretty clear in California, and I'm sure is the case across the other states that have done expansion of all children, is that when you have a program for all children, that is the most powerful enrollment strategy you have, because then it says to families, I don't know if I'm eligible, I don't know which program I'm eligible for. It says simply, all children, just come in and we'll figure out which pot you fit into. And that's an important strategy. It's what has been actually implemented right at the local level. Across our state, we've had several counties and local communities that have come together as a community and said, we want to make sure we've rounded it off and provided universal coverage for children in our area. And the impacts have been tremendous. You can expect, and what we've seen has been the amazing impact on utilization and health, but also the impact on enrollment. For every newly eligible child that comes in, 1 to 2 children who were already eligible for state insurance also came in. So it was that, in fact, that example of how much enrollment can improve when you have a system of all children. We've been working on covering all children in California for the last 3 years, and we've had just tremendous support. We're in a coalition with very active business groups like the LA Chamber of Commerce, Small Business California, PICO, churches, teachers, our California Teachers Association, all have really stepped up and are pushing for this and have set this as a priority. The public clearly supports this. We do regular polling on this. And it's across bipartisan and partisan lines that this is supported and across the state. And California, despite what you think, is not just LA and San Francisco. So it is actually very culturally diverse and politically diverse. And across all those that spectrum is the support. And we're very excited that the governor and the legislative leadership have all come out very strongly in support of covering all children in California. And when we say all children, we mean all children in California, including undocumented immigrant children. As the speaker of the assembly says, and as the governor says, the only card that matters to us is that the child has a clean bill of health. And the governor has said in very explicit terms that he thinks that we should be covering all children because they are the children that are here. And so that's an absolutely positive sign. What we're looking for is covering all children. We want to go up to 300% through the expansion programs. We want it to start right away because the local programs are running out of funding to continue what they're doing. And then also we borrowed some of the positive and good strategies from Pennsylvania, again, in a buy-in program to 300%. Now, this is our proposal. Where we are right now is in the legislature. The governor came out this year with a really comprehensive, I think many people were really surprised at how well thought out and comprehensive the full reform was that he was putting forward. And it his tenet on this is that he wants to have everybody in. It should be a shared responsibility. He doesn't want to do incremental because that's not how you fix the overall system, that everybody has to be in, everybody's paying, and then everybody benefits. He does cover all children. As what I didn't mention up there is that he also realizes that if you're going to have an individual mandate, you need to make enrollment easier. So he went also further and is going to be including several enrollment simplifications, including getting rid of the ACID test, which has just been Achilles' heel for California. The legislature also has proposals. They're more focused in on employer-based systems. They do expand the children's health programs, but it's a matter of financing, whether the financing is there to make it real. Now, just a little political landscape here. The governor doesn't have anybody that will introduce his bill, so he does not have legislation. Instead, he's going to produce language, and he's been working across the state and talking with all sorts of stakeholders about getting their input and working on a compromise. The legislature, in turn, does have language, obviously, and is working that through the process, and hopefully will have a compromise and something that the governor will sign by the deadline in August. And we're hoping that that will all happen and working really hard to make sure that whatever's in there, it includes all children. And clearly what's going to be an essential piece to all this is that the SCHIP reauthorization needs to include the sufficient funding. I can't tell you enough about how important it's going to be that California and all the other states do, in fact, get that increase. It isn't fluff. It's actual money that is needed just to continue our programs in California. Right now we have a shortfall. We can't even keep our current caseload unless we have an increase in funding, let alone to keep find the children that are eligible and to expand to 300%. We think that flexibility is going to be really important. And as well as we don't want to be taking a step back, as was in the DRA citizenship documentation, all the technology and all the innovations that we're trying to do, this will be really slowing us down. And you've obviously seen the impact of that in several other states. So we're hoping that there can be, again, some flexibility there on for states to implement that in the way that they think is best. And also, as I mentioned, some of the provisions that were in the Lugar-Bingaman bill on Express Lane, we'd like to see those included in the SCHIP reauthorization. And I think finally, most importantly, we really want to make sure this happens this year because a lot of states are on the line here expanding and bringing more children in. And to have that delayed or have just a one-year extension is really going to put things in jeopardy. So we really hope that Congress can pass a bill and get it signed this year so that states can continue the good work that they're doing.
Thank you to our panelists. And now we welcome questions from the audience. And if you would please raise your hand so we can get a mic to you and then identify yourself for the panelists as you pose your question.
Terry Langston, Public Welfare Foundation. This is all wonderful, and especially Louisiana, given that the political situation in the South, for those of us who care so much about the South, what is it that, I mean, the 103 to nothing is an astounding, absolutely astounding. What factors, in fact, health care coverage and the whole health care issue is a political issue first? And it's everything else second. What are the factors that have enabled this these real significant steps to be taken in Louisiana? What political factors?
In 1998, when the legislature passed the SCHIP legislation and established the SCHIP program, it was much more of an issue of should the state do it or should we not do it. One of the things we've done is we have incrementally increased enrollment. And I think that that we have run the program very very efficiently and very effectively, and the legislature and the public likes what they see. All of the major daily newspapers in Louisiana, their editorial pages support LCHIP, support enrollment for children and coverage. And that is just a commitment that was made that, you know, this is the generation that we want to see get health coverage. And I would repeat that we had every year, this is the first year in the 10 years that I've worked in Baton Rouge that we have not gone into the legislative session looking at the prospect of, you know, of cuts, large cuts in the billion-dollar range in the Medicaid budget. But this was something that was the priority, was health coverage for kids.
I think Ruth may be a little reluctant to also say that what we've heard today is it also takes leadership. And clearly the people on this panel are all leaders in fighting for coverage of children. The governor's statement, I think, really shows us that you need somebody advocating to the annoyance factor, but clearly there has been a lot of leadership in providing coverage through the southern states, and in fact much of the movement in the 90s to even expand Medicaid coverage for pregnant women and children came out of the work in the southern states with the high infant mortality rate. So I think it really does reflect both a long-term commitment and leadership.
Back.
Ruth, can you expand a little bit more on the details of the FOA option that Louisiana, the Family Opportunity Act, and then the other panelists, if you're aware of other states that are looking at an FOA waiver?
Can you repeat that? I didn't. I know the Family Opportunity Act, but the last half of that question.
Oh, it's on. Just in terms of the other, if Nicole and Christine, if you know if California's considering an FOA option and if there are other southern states that you know of, Nicole, that might be looking. Is everyone familiar with the Family Opportunity Act? Or maybe you can talk a little bit about what you mentioned that Louisiana is putting forward an FOA waiver.
Yes. The Deficit Reduction Act created a new optional Medicaid coverage group for children who meet the disability factor and who are not eligible for Medicaid in that state with income between 200 and 300% of the federal poverty level. It's going to be phased in year one, the first federal fiscal year, which is this year, is children ages 6 and under. And beginning in October of this year, we can enroll children ages 12 and under. And then the third year, we'll get all children under 18. We have the I'm not aware of any other state that has implemented, because I know we were looking to see how they had created their policies. But there is, the CMS does have a template for the state plan amendments for the Family Opportunity Act, and we're looking, our date when we intend to implement is October at this point. And so at that point, we will be able to enroll children ages 12 and under. And children with special needs need, you know, comprehensive benefits. And regardless of what happens as far as the delivery system is under the Family Opportunity Act, they would be in Medicaid with all the protections that are in Medicaid.
Kristen, could you speak a little bit more about the pilot program that you're running using the WIC enrollment data? And are you using that to proactively go out to families whose children would be eligible to enroll, or are you copying the data when those people come to you and enrolling them that way?
It hasn't started yet, we will be – the intent is that when folks come into WIC sites – and either they're already enrolled in WIC sites and they're coming in for a visit, or if they're signing up for WIC, at that point, when they're in the WIC site, they could be asked, do you want to sign up for health insurance? Because they typically ask whether you do have an insurance and what type. So it's natural then to ask, would you like to sign up right now for health insurance? And then they use the data that they already have, either as they're collecting it for the application for WIC, or they already have it on file in their data system. They can take that and populate and screen them for eligibility. The way the system would work, and this is a system that we have with our prevention program already, is that it'll in real time send to the health insurance program systems to say, are they already enrolled? Yep, they look at enrolls, and in real time send back saying, yep, okay, we've signed them up. So they'll be basically presumptively eligible right then and there. So they'll walk away with a card with a number on it so that they can go to the doctor right then and there. In the meantime, the data system, we have county systems, so it would have to channel to all the different counties. But in the meantime, that will be processed at the health insurance programs, and any other follow-up information the family will be followed up with. So that's ostensibly how it's going to work. But it hasn't started just yet. I did want to make sure you knew that we also had a report in your packet called the Healthy Snapshot, which talks a lot about what technologies are available and are being used across the state in the various ways in the enrollment system and systems.
Hi, my name is Flavio. I'm working with the American Medical Student Association. My question is, how are states dealing with the new stringent requirements on enrollment imposed by the DRA? And in addition to this, are there any programs in the states to ensure coverage for immigrant children, especially in the context of the wave of immigrants that are coming into Louisiana to help the reconstruction efforts post-Katrina? And obviously, also, this is a question for California.
You're talking about the new citizenship and identity verification requirement that was effective July 1st. The thing that has been most helpful for us is that we have online access for our caseworkers to our vital records system. For any child born in Louisiana, we're able to, within 30 to 45 seconds, to verify their citizenship. We've had the biggest challenges with children who were born in our lower Mississippi Delta parishes in northeast Louisiana. Immediately across the Mississippi River are the towns of Vicksburg and Natchez, Mississippi. And many of them were born there, and so they have a Mississippi birth certificate rather than a Louisiana birth certificate. And that has been the biggest challenge. But we're dealing with that and assisting families and giving them, the children already enrolled, that reasonable opportunity. We don't have any state-funded program in Louisiana right now to provide coverage for not otherwise eligible immigrant children. One of the things in the Snow-Rockefeller-Kennedy CHIP reauthorization bill is a provision that would give states the option to cover legal immigrant children in their SCHIP or Medicaid programs.
Kristen.
In California, there's going to be about – there's –
about 3.3 million people that will be affected by the citizenship documentation. And California did a similar sort of vital statistics check. And unfortunately, about half of them, I mean, that's good that we were able to find about half of them in the system, but that's another half that now we're going to have to find their own IDs and documentation of citizenship. So that will have a tremendous effect. And we also have a county-based system. So in addition to just the basic barrier that that's going to create of now having to provide this documentation is the fact that there's a very carefully thought through implementation strategy that now has to be implemented in 58 different counties. So that means massive system changes for each one of these counties, which we're really concerned about how that will impact. The state's doing its best to try and implement this in a way that is going to help the families as much as possible, but it's certainly going to be something that's very significantly going to impact enrollment. On legal immigrants, California, despite when the federal government dropped its federal match for those children, California continued to cover them because they felt it was important. So we do think that the federal government should go back and reinstate their partnership in that. So we hope to see that in SCHIP reauthorization as well.
Hi, I'm Joan Alker with the Georgetown Center for Children and Families. And I had a question for the panelists. As we all know, CHIP reauthorization is marching forward in Congress this summer. And one of the issues that has come up a lot in the last week or so is the issue of crowd out, to what extent children have dropped private coverage to enter the CHIP program. And I was wondering if any of the panelists could comment on that based on any of their experiences in their states.
Let's start. All three of you get to comment on that if you want.
The Southern Institute commissioned some research by the Moore School of Business at the University of South Carolina a couple of years ago across the southern states, and really found we wanted to look at this issue of what were the rates of employer-sponsored health coverage that were being provided to the lower wage families, and found that the rate at which they were even being offered, let alone enrolled in those programs, were not very high across the southern region. So this concept of the children swapping in and out, they don't have that coverage to begin with in which to move in many of those southern states, it's especially in those income levels under 200% of poverty.
I think the degree of crowd out differs among states, but in Louisiana it has been very minimal. The availability of employer-sponsored insurance is a much lower probability that families have access, even in 1998. And if anything, they have less access now than they did then. The Urban Institute did research and has results to show that in the SCHIP program in Louisiana, LCHIP, is that only 19.3% of children enrolled had ever had private insurance in their entire lives, and that the percentage of children who had it in the last 6 months before enrolling was 10.5%, and so, which says that even if they had it in the last 6 months, that doesn't mean that it was still available at the point that they enrolled. So we believe that there's while there may have been a small amount of crowd out, is not at the degree that that some of the reports are showing, not in Louisiana.
In California, we have by design that you can't have employer coverage to get into our Healthy Families program. And so it's targeted towards uninsured. But our state agency had commissioned an independent analysis of how many children were, in fact, coming in that did have employer coverage. And they had found that, and they were denied, because if you had it within 3 months, you weren't going to be able to get Healthy Families coverage, but it only amounted to 8% in our state. So it was a very minor number of children. So most of them were coming in, didn't have insurance.
Okay. And a question here.
I'm Sam Seaman with the Metropolitan Washington Public Health Association. We've heard the trend of states covering more people all under the private health insurance system. Those of us who think a single payer might be the way to go, is this undercutting that effort? Even Governor Rendell twice today said single payer might not be all that terrible.
Single payers have got quite a huge contingency in California. And I think how some of the leading advocates in California who have talked about, who are very strong advocates for single payer, have talked about it in the context of this larger reform, including our speaker has said that's the gold standard, but there are some steps we can take to get there. And include the Nurses Association, which have been incredibly active single-payer advocates, have come out in support of our children's, all kids legislation, because they feel that that's a good first step. So I wouldn't call them incrementalists. They're very active in trying to move to single-payer and continue to do so, but see that as an important first step, including Senator Kuhl, who's been a champion for single-payer.
Okay, last question.
Hi, Adam Brockmeyer from the National Association of Health Vendors. I'll stand up here. The Congressional Budget Office late last week released a report stating that 25 to 50% of children enrolled in SCHIP had private coverage before enrolling in the program. Do you feel that report is accurate?
Well, I think, first of all, from what I understand the report, they were saying have some access to some insurance, and I don't know that they really defined it, what it is. So that kind of makes a pretty broad brush of what's available, but it doesn't mean that's actually available as far as affordability and something that's meaningful. But like I said, in California, that's not been the experience of what we've seen. We've seen that people coming in, for children coming into the Children's Health Insurance Program, we go up to 250%. So clearly, these are families that are in the working environment. They don't have any insurance, so they are not insured and are not moving from their employer's coverage into other insurance. They don't have insurance.
I would only add, too, that the research that we did for the southern region, that even if they were offered that coverage, the amount that they had to pay, the employer were not contributing a significant amount of money to allow the employee or to their dependent to enroll in that, affordably enroll in that program.
So what we've learned today is that if the goal is to cover all children, we know what works to get many children enrolled. Many of the key elements have been tried in the states and are being part of the renewal discussion over reauthorization of the SCHIP program. I think what we really learned today, though, was that it takes innovation and it really takes leadership. And we had a good start with the governor, but a great panel following up of leaders who are really putting these practices in place in the states and helping to create a wave that may become the tidal wave that really provides universal coverage and especially coverage for children. So I want to thank all of our panelists today, and I hope you take away some good lessons. And this is a start in getting the right issues on the table as we move forward with the SCHIP reauthorization. And thank you all for coming.